Welcome to University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. It's been 100 years since women won the right to vote in the United States. But for women in the Wyoming Territory, that right came in 1869. On today's show, we talk about the long, strange trip that resulted in women in Wyoming being enfranchised so early and why it's deeply intertwined with race and colonization. My guest today is Virginia Scharf, Distinguished Professor Emeritus of History at the University of New Mexico and Senior Scholar with the Autry Museum of the American West in Los Angeles. Also, we'll talk about how women's suffrage played out in New Mexico and how Hispanic women played a key role in that change with Marcy Botwick. She's a library information specialist with the College of University Libraries and Learning Services, and she's one of several researchers who created an exhibit at Zimmerman Library on suffrage in the state. Virginia, let me start with you. Why did Wyoming, of all places, was the first one for women to get the vote?
Well, and people are always really stunned when I tell them that women first won the vote in the United States in Wyoming Territory in 1869, because Wyoming was anything but really under the control of the United States at that point. The Transcontinental Railroad was kind of pushing through there on its way west with the Union Pacific to meet ultimately in Utah, up with the Central Pacific coming eastward from California. Most of the territory was under the control of the native people who had lived there far before the United States ever thought about being in a place that it was going to call Wyoming. And so how the heck did this even happen? And the answer to that is that it's a coincidence of the fact that the woman suffrage movement was getting organized in the period after the Civil War as an independent movement. Of course, women had been working for their rights since the 1840s, when many, many American women were involved in the abolitionist movement. And that movement kind of crossed over a lot with the emerging movement for women's rights. And that's a long story in itself. But by the 1860s, women are starting to organize, and some men, frankly, for woman suffrage. But as it happened in Wyoming, that movement kind of overlapped with the fact that American settlers, and particularly the Republicans who were in charge of the appointed offices in the state government, really wanted to try to attract white women out to Wyoming Territory, because they thought this was going to be the way, if white families came, this would be the way that Wyoming Territory would really be settled by white people and enable them to unsettle the native people who lived there. And of course, at that time, most of the white men who were in Wyoming were single men. There was a little mining boom in South Pass City, Wyoming. They would be miners, or they were soldiers who were being demobilized from the army or deserting from the army, or railroad workers. And so these are not the kind of guys who are very reliable for settling. They're the kind of guys who go there, get a paycheck, get drunk, and move on. And so they thought that stable American families would take up homesteads in Wyoming, and they wanted to figure out what would be some good incentives for this. And as it happened, there was a Democratic state legislator, the entire state legislature, territorial legislature that was elected in Wyoming were Democrats. And a lot of them were guys who were veterans of the Union Army, but had come from borderland states, or people who were not necessarily dedicated to the cause of civil rights for African Americans, or
yes, this was the Democratic Party of old that affiliated with slavery, and
I think it's really important to make that distinction, that these were Democrats who were, you know, in some cases they would have been Union officers, but they were, or Union enlisted men, or Confederate veterans who were happened to be, who better to go out to pull up stakes and go out to the West than somebody who'd been from Virginia. The guy who introduced the woman's suffrage bill was a Virginian who had been in the Union Army, a guy named William Bright. And really, these are white supremacist people who believe that, number one, the most important thing and the destiny of white people was for them to just take the territory of what would become the continental United States. And number two, they just needed to kick out native people. And guys like William Bright thought that it was more important for a woman like his white wife to be able to vote than African-American men who had recently been granted citizenship and were struggling for the right to vote, the protection of their right to vote as well. So it had everything to do with the politics of race and empire. And ultimately, the Democrats in the legislature, a majority of them voted for this woman suffrage bill, the bill to give women the vote in Wyoming Territory. In some of them, because they thought it'd be good publicity and bring white women west. Others, because they thought it was a big joke. Some of them probably because they were drunk at the time, because there was a lot of booze in Wyoming at that time. And pretty much all of them figured that the governor would veto this crazy law. But the governor happened to be a radical Republican named John Campbell, who had been a brigadier general in the Union Army and was from Ohio and was an ardent, had been an ardent abolitionist and a radical. And he believed, that in the later words, you know, that the arc of justice bends forward. And so he thought, yeah, I'm going to sign this. I'm for it. I think this will bring settlement, but I also think it's the cause of justice. So it was in some ways, it was a kind of perfect storm of circumstances. But absolutely, the first victories in the West, in Wyoming and then in Utah Territory and other places in the West, were because of the politics of white settlement and settler colonialism.
It's a rather unsavory history in that light.
Well, yeah. You know, I think that we can always imagine, and the great scholar of culture and imperialism, Edward Said, and of Orientalism, what Said said is, we always know that empire is going to kick out really horrible things, but it also kicks out some unintended consequences that are actually good things. So I think the expansion of women's rights is prima facie a good thing. Unfortunately, it came with the baggage of racism that I think we're still grappling. We certainly are still grappling with, and nativism. I mean, the politics of empire in Wyoming, I talked about railroad workers. Let's remember that most of the railroad workers who are on the Central Pacific, who are going from California toward Utah, those are Chinese workers. And the newspapers in Wyoming, the one, the Frontier Index, that was the press on wheels that went west with the Union Pacific Railroad, they were all-purpose racist. They hated the Chinese workers. They hated Native people. They hated Black people. They hated Mexican workers. And so they had every kind of invective you can imagine. And we're still dealing with this legacy. And I think it's important for us to grapple with that if we're ever going to seize on the promise of the Declaration of Rights for Everybody.
You brought up Julia Bright, and it was interesting that you sort of contrasted her with being held up as sort of, here's this white woman who could have this effect on Wyoming that these people saw as positive, versus a woman like Calamity Jane, who is a lot more wild than even people may realize.
Well, I think that's kind of funny to think about the romanticization of Calamity Jane over the years. I remember seeing the movie about her starring Doris Day, and was kind of tough at the beginning, but she cleans up real nice and all that sort of thing. And of course, Martha Jane Canary, who was Calamity, known as Calamity Jane, was a woman. She was basically a cross-dressing, sometime prostitute, maybe drove a stagecoach, maybe did a little scouting for the army, foul-mouthed, drunken kind of person who, her biggest offenses against femininity was that she appropriated all of the worst behaviors of men. And so, you know, this is where she's seen as somebody. But she also evidently did some nursing and some epidemics. You got to give, nobody is only one thing. Nobody is a simple person. So we look at a woman also like William Bright's wife, Julia Bright, who evidently was in favor of the cause of woman suffrage. And later, the greatest opponent of woman suffrage, this guy Ben Sheeks, who was also a legislator who had voted against the bill and actually introduced a bill to rescind woman suffrage the year after it was passed. This guy, Ben Sheeks, he said, well, you know, I thought that Julia Bright put William Bright up to introducing that piece of legislation because she was much better educated and had a better character than he did. So in many ways, you can say, all right, you know, this is a person who if you believe in the project of settling white Americans on newly acquired or newly claimed territory, then you really do need churches and schools and the kind of social institutions that women volunteered to found to create communities in the West. And so somebody like Julia Bright, in theory, is precisely the person you want out there to kind of settle down her husband in case he's behaving badly, to raise the kids, to do the nursing if there's problems, to deliver the meals to the elderly, whatever it is, to teach school. At the same time, you have to understand that all of these noble goals of establishing these communities in places like Albuquerque, New Mexico, they're also about unsettling other people and about repressing the rights of previous inhabitants and of some immigrants, for example, African-American people who come west, you know, relegating them as well to second-class citizenship.
This is University Showcase. I'm Megan Kamrick. We're talking about women's suffrage in the West with Distinguished Professor Emeritus of History Virginia Scharf and Library Information Specialist Marcy Botwick. How did what happened in Wyoming, how was that emblematic of what happened across much of the West?
Well, what happens in other places? So, for example, in Utah, the law that enfranchised women that they passed in 1870, and in fact, Utah women vote first. There's an election in Utah where women go to the polls before they go in Wyoming. And that was because prominent Mormon men, who many of whom were polygamists, the most prominent among them, thought it was a great idea for white women to vote because they thought that women would just vote as their husbands did, and they had multiple wives. And they thought this would be an instrument by which the Mormon church could actually exert a kind of lasting influence on Utah politics. So that was their original reason for doing it. And in some ways, the Mormons, I think, we have to understand, we're in many, many ways the most successful colonization experiment in the American West. So you can see where this has to do with the whole politics of colonizing Utah. Other places in the West, and my theory has kind of been that other Western states looked at the fact that Wyoming territory and Utah territory, other territories, looked at the fact that this could happen here and said, well, gee whiz, if it can happen in Wyoming of all places, we could get it done in Washington or Oregon or Colorado. And in many ways, women were able to mobilize their campaigns for suffrage without there being the kind of organized opposition that there was further east. And so there was a kind of cascading effect so that most Western territories and states, most Western states by the time of 1920, had already passed woman suffrage laws long before Eastern states had and long before the federal amendment was passed in 1919 and then ratified in 1920.
That's so interesting. I want to turn to you, Marcy Botwick, because this process played out rather differently in New Mexico, and I know that this small exhibit that you all have at the Zimmerman Library looks at some of that. Could you talk a little bit about how, in contrast, Hispanic women actually had a crucial role to play in getting the 19th Amendment passed here?
No, they absolutely did. And in fact, New Mexico was one of the only states that did not pass women's suffrage when they became a state. And there's been some conjecture.
And that was 1912, I just wanted to add.
That was 1912, yep. Exactly. There's been some conjecture that there was infighting, basically, at the state level, that if Hispanic men were given the vote, then women shouldn't be given the vote. Honestly, from what I could tell, there isn't a surety about that, and there needs to be more research and some more looking at what actually happened at the time to really know for certain if that was the case. But that's sort of been the rumor for many, many years. But as things move forward, after they didn't receive the vote, women became very energized in New Mexico to make sure that we did. There were women that before that time were also energized. There was a woman by the name of Ida Morley. She lived up in Dadle in the late 1800s. She raised her kids and ranched up there and wrote hundreds and hundreds of letters to state governments and to the national government to get suffrage passed, to no effect. But in any case, after 1912, when suffrage wasn't passed in New Mexico, the CUWS, which was the national organization that was leading the effort for suffrage, they started sending organizers out here to work with the women's clubs. And the women's clubs of New Mexico, which were federated under an organization called the New Mexico Federation of Women's Clubs, were the leading force behind making sure that suffrage got passed. And that wasn't just true here. I think that was true pretty much in many places across the country. Women's clubs were places where women could gather and talk about the things that were interesting to them, make sure that social actions were brought to bear, both around abolition and temperance and children's rights and women's rights. They were one of the first places that women found power, political power, outside their homes. So these women's clubs were the organizing forces then for the suffrage clubs that came and helped pass suffrage. So they sent out Mabel Vernon and other state organizers to Albuquerque to start organizing. And there were several important women who were chosen by Alice Paul and some of the other national leaders in New Mexico to help lead the effort. One was Julia Asplund. She moved here in 1903. She was actually the first librarian at the University of New Mexico and the first trained librarian in the state.
Oh, that's great. That's a nice through line for you guys being this exhibit in the Zimmerman Library.
Exactly right. And she moved out here in order to organize the university library. And then she quickly became involved in all sorts of social movements, including suffrage. She ended up in Santa Fe, but continued her work there for organizing libraries for the state and was the first state librarian as well. She was very involved in the Republican Party, which, as you mentioned, the Republican Party was very much in favor of suffrage, whereas the Democratic Party was not. And that went on to play a large role also in the New Mexico history with suffrage. One of the other really lead figures was a woman named Nina Otero Warren. She was a member of both the Lucero and Otero families, which were very politically influential families at the time. She was originally from Los Lunas, and she was Hispanic. She grew up in Los Lunas, but she lived most of her life in Santa Fe. And she got picked by Alice Paul to help lead the movement here. She helped elect Andreas Jones, who ended up being the chair of the Senate Committee on Women's Suffrage. And he was the man who eventually helped push the suffrage bill through to passage in 1919. She also then helped assure that the amendment was ratified at the state level, which was the next piece in making sure that women's suffrage was assured across the nation. 36 states, after it was passed at the federal level, 36 states had to pass it at the state level. New Mexico is the 32nd state to pass suffrage, but it was a big fight. And she was called in, apparently, in the waning hours of this specially convened session of the state legislature in order to help push this through.
And she really helped bring Hispanic or Latina women into what had been kind of a mostly Anglo movement, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
And she was picked for that reason.
Okay.
She and a woman named Aurora Lucero. Aurora is known for having delivered a speech in Spanish at a very important Albuquerque rally. She also helped develop Spanish language public relations, basically, to help promote suffrage around the state and to galvanize Hispanic women to come out and to basically push their husbands to make sure that this happened. Not as much is written about Aurora. So one of my goals as a librarian and putting this exhibit together was to let people know that the Center for Southwest Research has all sorts of original source documents and research that needs to be done, really, on some of the people who were involved in the suffrage movement in New Mexico. The information is out there. It's buried in a lot of old newspapers to which we have access and which are digitized. But we need students and people to really want to get involved and to take a look at this so that we can really flesh out the history and understand it better. So,
and I should, I think, tell me if I'm wrong, but as we heard, like states like Wyoming, other Western states, they passed suffrage by popular vote. As I understand, New Mexico allowed for limited suffrage, school suffrage. Women could vote in school elections. But the 1910 Constitution required 3/4 majority of voters in each county, mind you, to make additional changes in suffrage laws. So that's why the women who were organizing here decided to focus on getting a national amendment passed.
Correct. That was also the prevailing wisdom at the time. That was a fight within the suffrage movement as a whole, whether or not it should be a national amendment or it should be state by state. And so at that time, the National Movement and Alice Paul, as I helped lead that towards the passing it at the federal level and then going for state amendments rather than asking each state to vote it in as Wyoming and many of the other Western states did. That was also sort of like part of the bigger history around this.
And you have this exhibit at the Zimmerman Library. As I say, we're in the middle of strange times now. Is the Zimmerman open right now? I don't even know. Can people go look at it?
No, unfortunately.
Okay.
Unfortunately, we are working behind the scenes. We still have staff on site to make sure that everybody has the resources that they need and we can answer their questions and provide things that maybe we hadn't thought about. But unfortunately, the building is closed right now.
So eventually, when we reopen, hopefully soon, we're not sure when, but that will still be there. People can go see it.
I sure hope so. We had some other plans, but I'm hoping that those will be put on hold given that the exhibition is not going to have its full run. But we'll post that up on the library information pages, and so you'll be able to find out.
But also, as you're saying, the Center for Southwest Research has all these materials people could start diving into, researchers or writers or historians.
Exactly.
And there's things perhaps people can also see online.
Absolutely. And that's through the Center for Southwest Research.
Okay.
That's also through a website called And Yet She Persisted. Most of the materials that are up in the exhibition are also up in And Yet She Persisted. I can give you the way to get to that online.
I will. Yeah, I will link to that on KUNM.org along with this interview. If you just joined us, this is University Showcase on KUNM. I'm Megan Kamrick. It's been 100 years since women won the right to vote in the United States, and we're talking about how suffrage played out in the West and in New Mexico with Distinguished Professor Emeritus of History, Virginia Scharf. Also joining us is Library Information Specialist Marcy Botwick, who, with her colleagues, created an exhibit about women's suffrage in New Mexico. So we get the 19th Amendment. This does not, for the most part, include Native Americans.
Nope.
When does that change?
Well, that doesn't actually change until 1945, when all Native people win the right to vote, in part because it was argued that they were domestic dependent nations or wards of the state or whatever the language of the various forms of American law was. Native people were not seen as entitled to full citizenship until 1945, when they finally actually do manage to win that right to full citizenship. So, I think what you have to see is that merely being, and in fact, I heard a brilliant presentation by a scholar named Lisa Tetreault, who looked very closely at the language of the 19th Amendment. And all these amendments say, all of the civil rights amendments of the Civil War and Reconstruction period, all of that stuff, all it says is that states cannot deny certain kinds of rights on the basis of, in the case of the Reconstruction amendments, of race or previous condition of servitude. What the 19th Amendment says is states cannot deny. But what that doesn't tell us is that rights are guaranteed. They are not guaranteed. Rights are never guaranteed. And so we are in a constant struggle to protect and to preserve and, in fact, to restore rights that, as we have seen in the last 3 years, can continuously be undermined and assaulted. And we look at voter suppression measures and other kinds of things that have been used to undermine the rights that we keep thinking are guaranteed, but they're not, and we have to keep fighting for them.
In New Mexico, actually, Native Americans were not granted the vote until 1948, when they actually sued the government for it. But even after it was given nationally in our state, it wasn't given until Michael Trujillo, or Miguel Trujillo, sued to gain his rights, and it was only at that point that they were given. So, as Virginia was just saying, rights can be abridged and taken away unless they're assured and guaranteed in other ways.
I was doing some research on this, and the Santa Fe New Mexican had written about the Trujillo case, and apparently, prior to this, the state's constitution prohibited from voting, quote, idiots, insane persons mm-hmm. convicted of felonious or infamous crime unless restored to political rights, and Indians not taxed, which specifically meant Native Americans living on reservations.
Well, Correct. Yeah, and that's language that comes all the way back from the United States Constitution, this language of Indians not taxed. So, I mean, the fact that the Trujillo case doesn't happen until 1948, it gives you a sense of the long time horizon of the struggle for fulfillment of the promise of the Declaration of Independence. And I just really want to encourage everybody who's listening to us talk today, and thank you so much for correcting my timeline and giving really important information and showing how important New Mexico has been in the struggle for our rights in the United States. Just to really remind people that this is really all up to us, and defending our rights is a project that we can't ever tire of pursuing.
Exactly right. And that's also why I wanted this exhibition to go up, because the voting rights issues that we're facing today are equally as serious as any we've ever faced. And they're really the same as what they were when we were fighting for suffrage 100 years ago in many ways. So I think it's a really timely exhibit and a really timely issue that just there was no way as a library that we could ignore it.
Well, this has been a fantastic conversation at a difficult time in our history in many ways. So it's a good reminder to look back and learn from the lessons of history and not forget them and keep fighting for them.
Well, we're not only in a public health crisis, and that's going to test us as nothing in our history ever has before. And there's no maximizing the effect of the coronavirus on our institutions and on our daily life. But at the same time, we're also engaged in an existential struggle for our democracy. And both of these things have to go on at the same time. We have to take care of each other as a community, as a global community, and figure out ways within our isolation to connect with each other. And that's why I'm grateful to be involved in this conversation. But we also are engaged in this constant effort to undermine our democracy. And we have to be mindful of that as well.
Thank you both so much for talking about this. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Megan, for inviting us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
That was Distinguished Professor Emeritus of History Virginia Scharf and Library Information Specialist Marcy Botwick. Scharf was slated to give a lecture on women's suffrage in the West this week, but it was postponed due to the coronavirus outbreak. You can find links to the exhibit Botwick and her colleagues created at KUNM.org, as well as other resources on these issues at the Center for Southwest Research. Thanks to Associate Professor David Bashwinner for our theme music. I'm Megan Kamrick. Thanks for listening to University Showcase.